If I were to let my imagination loose, Adams continued, I should wish you had been a member of Napoleon's Institute at Cairo. Nay, farther, I could find it in my heart to wish that you had been at the head of 100,000 Israelites, indeed as well disciplined as a French army, and marching with them into Judea. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 146, Napoleon and John Adams. I'm Mayor Soloveitchik. It was in 1799, during Napoleon's campaign in the Middle East, that one of the most important publications in France issued a striking announcement about the French warriors' intentions. As the historian Shlomo Ben Ami tells us, quote, "The French Revolution's newspaper Le Moniteur Universel published a notice that claimed that Napoleon's campaign sought to reinstate Jewish independence, referring to the Jews as the legal heirs of the land of Israel," end quote. How much weight are we to give this paper's pronouncement? Some historians see the Napoleon of 1799 as embodying a sort of proto-Zionist figure. Thus, Haaretz gives us the following from an interview with another prominent Israeli historian. Quote, "Napoleon was the first to see the Jews as a political force in the international arena," says Professor Mordechai Gichon, a military historian and archaeologist from Tel Aviv University's Classical Studies Department. Gichon's book, Napoleon in the Holy Land, sums up almost 40 years of research on the subject. Most of the material comes from France's war archive, as well as journals and books written by soldiers in Napoleon's army. Napoleon's idea to establish a national home for the Jews in the land of Israel, Gichon says, stemmed primarily from political considerations. It came to him on the backdrop of the crumbling of the Ottoman Empire and the competition for its spoils with England, Gichon says. Napoleon believed the Jews would repay his favors by serving French interests in the region. End quote. So Gichon argues, and there are those, including Simon Montefiore in his book Jerusalem, who cite a message to the Jews linked to Napoleon, dated right after the Battle of Mount Tabor, telling the Jews to rise and claim their historic destiny in the Holy Land. As best as I can tell, the authenticity of this pronouncement is at least debated by historians, but, as Ben Ami notes, the publicly pronounced link between Napoleon's attempt to conquer the land of the Bible and the future of Jewish sovereignty there had a real impact on Jewish thinking. Mordechai Gichon, as the article in Haaretz further mentions, fascinatingly notes that 100 years after Napoleon's battle in the region, Theodor Herzl, lobbying Kaiser Wilhelm, wrote as follows, quote, "What couldn't be fulfilled under the rule of Napoleon can be fulfilled by Wilhelm II," end quote. The story of Herzl's ultimate meeting with Wilhelm in the Holy Land is one that we will tell in this series, but the Kaiser, of course, did not become a supporter of Herzl's project. There is, however, one other major political figure who, long before 1899, seemed to link Napoleon's battles in the Middle East with the Jewish political future, and understanding this sheds new light on a remarkable piece of correspondence from a remarkable American founding father. In 1818, the prominent American Jew Mordechai Noah delivered an address in Congregation Sherith Israel in New York. After describing the greatness of the United States and the incredible embrace that Jews had found there, Noah then issued a proto-Zionist reflection, saying, quote, "Never were prospects for the restoration of the Jewish nation to their ancient rights and dominion more brilliant than they are at present. There are upwards of 7 million of Jews known to be in existence throughout the world, a number greater than at any period in our history and possessing more wealth, activity, influence, and talents than any body of people of their number on earth," end quote. And Noah then said, quote, "Let us then hope that the day is not far distant when, from the operation of liberal and enlightened measures, we may look towards that country where our people have established a mild, just, and honorable government, accredited by the world and admired by all good men," end quote. Noah sent the address, describing both the greatness of American freedom as well as his dream of the restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the Holy Land, to several former presidents, including Jefferson and Adams. Jefferson, who ardently believed in human rights and full religious and political equality for the Jews, but who nevertheless reveals in his own private correspondence that he did not think highly of the legacy of Judaism, responded to Noah by emphasizing the importance of religious liberty. Jefferson wrote, quote, "I thank you for the discourse on the consecration of the synagogue in your city, with which you have been pleased to favor me. I have read it with pleasure and instruction, having learned from it some valuable facts in Jewish history which I did not know before. Your sect by its sufferings has furnished a remarkable proof of the universal spirit of religious intolerance. inherent in every sect, disclaimed by all while feeble and practiced by all when in power. Our laws have applied the only antidote to this vice, protecting our religious as they do our civil rights by putting all on an equal footing. But more remains to be done. For although we are free by the law, we are not so in practice. Public opinion erects itself into an inquisition and exercises its office with as much fanaticism as fans the flames of an auto-da-fé. The prejudice still scowling on your section of our religion, although the elder one, cannot be unfelt by yourselves. It is to be hoped that individual dispositions will at length mold themselves to the model of the law and consider the moral basis on which all our religions rest as the rallying point which unites them in a common interest, while the peculiar dogmas branching from it are the exclusive concern of the respective sects embracing them and no rightful subject of notice to any other, end quote. Meanwhile, John Adams, receiving this address, wrote back to Noah in his inimitable style, expressing his mind. And we know that Adams had already, in correspondence with non-Jews, reflected on his admiration for all that Judaism had given the world. Thus, upon receiving Noah's Sheirith Israel address, Adams wrote to Noah in part the following, quote, "I wish your nation may be admitted to all the privileges of citizens in every country of the world. This country has done much, I wish it may do more, and annul every narrow idea in religion, government, and commerce." And then soon after, Adams concluded the letter. "Let the wits yoke, the philosophers sneer. What then? It has pleased the providence of the first cause, the universal cause, that Abraham should give religion, not only to Hebrews, but to Christians and Mahometans, the greatest part of the modern civilized world. I am, sir, though a stranger, with much esteem, your humble and obliged servant, John Adams." End quote. Thus, on his own, unsolicited, Adams went out of his way to reflect on how the world owes monotheism to the Jews, how biblical monotheism in its different forms is linked to Abraham, the Hebrew, reflecting his own understanding of how thinkers such as Voltaire did not appreciate the incredible impact that Jews had on the world. And as I've described in my Tikva lectures on Jewish ideas in the American founding, the most fascinating letter from Adams was yet to come. A year later, Noah sent both Adams and Jefferson a memoir about his travels. Jefferson wrote a perfunctory reply. Adams, in contrast, wrote the following. Quote, "Dear sir, I have to thank you for another valuable publication, your travels in Europe and Africa, which though I cannot see well enough to read, I can hear as well ever, and accordingly have heard, read 2/3 of it, and shall in course hear all the rest. It is a magazine of ancient and modern learning, of judicious observations and ingenious reflections. I have been so pleased with it that I wish you had continued your travels into Syria, Judea, and Jerusalem. I should attend more to your remarks upon those interesting countries than to those of any traveler I have yet read. If I were to let my imagination loose," Adams continued, "I should wish you had been a member of Napoleon's Institute at Cairo. Nay, farther, I could find it in my heart to wish that you had been at the head of 100,000 Israelites, indeed as well disciplined as a French army, and marching with them into Judea, and making a conquest of that country, and restoring your nation to the dominion of it. For I really wish the Jews again in Judea an independent nation." End quote. Adams then, in his own candid way, went on in the letter to express his views that if the Jews attained sovereignty in the Holy Land, then they might lose what Adams called their quote-unquote peculiarities and adopt Adams's own approach to religion, which was Unitarianism. But this conclusion should not, for Jews, I think, undo the admiring aspects of Adams's letter. Adams believed that he was indebted to the Hebraic texts for his own faith, his own knowledge, his own understanding of morality. He was candid about his own religious beliefs, but also about his profound desire to see a Jewish return to the Holy Land. He showed his esteem for the Jewish people, how he believed that he was indebted to the Jewish people, how he believed that the whole world was indebted to the Jewish people, and around 100 years before the Balfour Declaration, he embraced the concept of a Jewish return to the Holy Land. And one sentence in the letter is, I think, of special interest to the story that we are telling in this podcast. Again, Adams wrote to Noah, quote, "I should wish you had been a member of Napoleon's Institute at Cairo. Nay, farther, I could find it in my heart to wish that you had been at the head of 100,000 Israelites, indeed as well disciplined as a French army, and marching with them into Judea," end quote. Adams is clearly inspired in his reflections by his memory and his own understanding of Napoleon's military operations in the Middle East. We should recall that the President of the United States during Napoleon's battles in the region was John Adams. And in the election of 1800, one of the most contentious in American history, The issue of American relations with France was the central one of contention between Adams's political party and that of Jefferson, as well as between Adams's faction in the Federalist Party and that of Hamilton. There is, I think, a clear link in this letter between Adams's recollection of Napoleon's battles and his own, Adams's own, expressed support for a future Jewish state. When Vice President Mike Pence visited the Knesset, the Prime Minister of Israel, who is now the Prime Minister of Israel, cited this phrase from Adams that, "I really wish the Jews again in Judea an independent nation." After the Prime Minister's welcome, the then leader of the Knesset opposition, who is now the President of Israel, also cited this very same letter, this very same sentence, this very same phrase. It is perhaps one of the wonders of history. A retired president in Quincy, Massachusetts, writes a letter in 1819 referencing a French army of 1799, and this letter, in the end, is cited in Jerusalem in the legislature of a Jewish state in the 21st century. A letter by Adams that heralded an American role in the future of Jerusalem and in the future of the Jewish state, one which will appear in episodes of Jerusalem 365 yet to come. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.